For Kitchen Window, I'm Bonnie Wolfe. Susie Chang is a New England-based freelance writer and writes cookbook reviews for the Boston Globe. She has written a piece on marinades for NPR's Kitchen Window Online. She joins me today. Hi, Susie.
Hi, Bonnie.
Marinades. Why do we use marinades?
Basically, the reason I use marinades is because they're the world's laziest summer meal. And I'm the world's laziest summer cook. You do the work up front. You know, you put together a marinade from as many different ingredients as you can stand, but you make a lot of it, and then you divide it up into batches, into plastic bags, and you freeze the plastic bags, and you throw them in the freezer. And then someday when you want a delicious grilled meal, you just take out the bag and you put some meat in it, and that's basically it. That's your prep. So,
wow.
Yeah, and then later on in the day, all you have to do is grill it. It's really a meal made with the greatest of ease.
And they thaw quickly.
They thaw quickly. The marinades do. You know, if you've got frozen meat, then you can thaw the meat and the marinade together safely but thoroughly if you know how to do that.
And what are the best ingredients for marinades?
Well, that's a very interesting question, Bonnie, because I have this whole theory of marinades. And I think that the successful marinade contains, without exception, the four S's: salt, sweet, sour, and savory. And also you can sometimes have spicy, the fifth S. You have an enormous variety of options. And in my article, I include a list of the different salty flavors, the different sweet flavors, the different sour ones, and the different savory ones that you can use.
Why are so many marinades Asian-inspired?
I have a theory about that, too. As you can tell, I have a theory about everything. But there aren't that many different ways that you can get that salty taste. You can use salt. But if you're using an Asian cuisine, you can use soy or fish sauce. And those two particular marinade ingredients, soy and fish sauce, in addition to being salty, also have that savory quality. And they carry the flavors deep into the meat and really create a delicious phenomenon almost every time that you use them. So I think that's why those Asian marinades based on soy and fish sauce really seem to succeed so well.
Now, there are so many bottled marinades. Mm-hmm. Why do you make your own?
Because it's so easy to do, and I'm cheap. It's really easy to make marinade. Basically, you can just connect the dots between these four or five different ingredients, and almost without fail, there will be a delicious marinade as an end result.
What kind of meats do you use marinades on?
Yeah, I think there's particular kinds that work really well. When I'm using red meat, I tend to go for very thin cuts. Thin, but juicy. So my favorite red meat cut for marinating is beef short rib, but cut flanken style, you know, so it's across the short rib, maybe a half inch thick, the way you would use it in Korean galbi, which I have a recipe for in the article.
Now, do you have to ask the butcher to cut it that way?
You do. Or you can use similar cuts of meat that are equally porous, the way that flanken cut is, our sirloin tip, or skirt steak. Those are good options as well.
And what about fish?
I actually don't tend to do fish. I do chicken, pork, and beef, because with fish, I don't actually find that marinating adds much to it. Grilling fish is a wonderful way to spend a summer weekday evening, but you don't really need a marinade for it.
What does the marinade do to the meat?
The marinade goes deep inside the meat and just gives it this flavor that permeates throughout the meat. If you can do it for 2 hours, that's okay, but the longer the better. If you can go for 8 hours or 4 hours or whatever you've managed to do, whether it's dropping it in the marinade the night before or the morning of, the longer it can sit in that marinade, the better it will taste.
If you make a batch of marinade for the next month, can you keep it in the refrigerator?
I wouldn't suggest it, because I think that the flavors tend to dull if they're allowed to develop in the refrigerator. Basically, I freeze plastic bags with marinade in them in the freezer, and I just take a bag out when I want to, and the flavor is as good as it was the day I made it.
Can you actually freeze the meat in the marinade?
You can, but that really doesn't do you much good, because the effect of the marinade doesn't begin until the marinade and the meat are thawed and acting on each other.
I see. And you talked about how wonderful marinades are for summer grilling. Do you use them throughout the year?
To tell the truth, I sometimes do. I love grilling so much that I can't stop in the summer. I actually grill right through, right to the point where the legs of the Weber grill are buried in snow.
Well, you do live in New England.
That's true.
Well, Susie, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Walmart created a stir a couple of years ago when it announced it was moving into the organic food market. Now the nation's top grocery seller is promoting its locally grown produce. The company touts the community benefits, but it's also a way for Walmart to cut down on fuel costs. Reporter Jenny O'Mara from member station KXJZ in Sacramento has more.
Some things you can expect to see at any Walmart you go to.
Okay, thank you for shopping Walmart. You have a nice day.
But at this West Sacramento Supercenter, there's something different. The produce area is covered with bright green and white signs, highlighting products that are California grown. Walmart says partnerships with local farmers have grown 50% over the past 2 years, and not just in California, but in Walmart stores across the country. This year, it plans to buy about $400 million of locally grown produce. Walmart spokeswoman Tiffany Moffitt says the primary benefit to the company is savings on fuel costs to the tune of millions of dollars a year. Local partnerships have become the company's latest PR mantra.
It's estimated that in the United States, produce travels an average of 1,500 miles from farms to homes of consumers. So it just provides us an opportunity to make products closer to home and buy local.
But the retailer's definition of what constitutes locally grown doesn't match the one promoted by many in the so-called local food movement. You'll find many of them at local farmers markets.
This is a scene usually associated with that local food movement, organic produce, small farmers, some who truck their products just a dozen or so miles down the road. That's not exactly what Walmart is talking about.
This is a weekly Saturday morning farmers market in Sacramento. Farmer Patrick Hoover is ladling blueberries into small plastic boxes and offering samples. He's driven less than 50 miles from his 40 acres up in the foothills to sell them. And that's what most locavores, the fans of locally grown food, say is real local food. Walmart says, on the other hand, anything grown in the same state is local food. Hoover says selling to Walmart doesn't really appeal to him.
The quality I have, I don't do any markets like that just because my stuff is picked ripe and the only shelf I want it on is between here and the customer at home. And sitting in any retail store is just not good for my produce.
But farmers who sell at such markets acknowledge their products are usually more expensive than what you find in the stores, due in part to the additional labor involved. Many of Walmart's local producers are large-scale farmers that can supply in bulk. Saving on fuel costs is one of the benefits to Walmart of this new locally grown strategy, and it certainly benefits local farmers. But Professor Dan Sumner says if the company's strategy catches on nationwide, it could spell problems for a major growing state like California, where much is shipped elsewhere. Sumner teaches agricultural economics at UC Davis.
If people decide they're going to consume locally, that means they're probably not consuming our walnuts and apricots and almonds and everything else we grow around here.
Still, locally grown might not be that big a selling point for Walmart customers. Back in the produce aisle at the West Sacramento Walmart, the locally grown theme isn't having much impact on Thomas Teeny, who says for him, it's all about the household bottom line.
We're kind of on a tight budget right now, the whole economy. It's not really that great of importance to us. We just buy what's cheap.
For NPR News, I'm Jenny O'Mara in Sacramento.
And now an anniversary. Today is an auspicious day in culinary history. 50 years ago, the first package of instant ramen noodles was sold in Japan. Commentator Andy Raskin is grateful for that.
In January 2007, media the world over noted the passing, at age 96, of Momofuku Ando, the inventor of instant ramen. When I found out that Ando's funeral would be held at a baseball stadium in Osaka, I used frequent flyer miles to get myself there. The stadium had been decorated to look like outer space, Blue lights twinkled in the bleachers and galaxies twirled on video monitors. 6,000 people sat in the dark on folding chairs facing the home run wall, where rows of Buddhist monks framed a long white stage. The theme was an homage to Space ROM, the instant noodle that Ando developed for astronauts, but also to Halley's Comet, which showed up in 1910, the year Ando was born. Ando had brought Raman from the heavens, and now he was returning home. The funeral included speeches by prime ministers and chanting by the monks, but there were also goodie bags. Each attendee received a 5-pack of chicken ramen, a container of cup noodles, and a book of Ando's famous sayings. I was struggling over whether to begin a career as a writer. Then I read the first saying in the book. I invented instant ramen when I was 48 and cup noodles at 61. In life, there is no such thing as too late. A few days later, after I flew home, a friend asked if she should leave her boyfriend. Unsure what to say, I opened Ando's book. One saying was related to his failure to sell a product called instant rice. When you enter a market, Ando had written, do it slowly. When you withdraw, do it quickly. My friend was single the next day. Soon all my friends wanted advice from the inventor of instant ramen. Flavors taste best to those who appreciate them, I counseled one. Food is balance, I instructed another. Still, some of the sayings were downright cryptic. One friend asked, should I propose to my girlfriend? I answered with Ando's most famous utterance, mankind is noodle kind. We debated what Ando meant by that, and eventually decided he meant my friend should propose. Then we cooked and ate the entire chicken ramen 5-pack. This year, instant ramen demand is expected to surpass 100 billion servings worldwide. Thank you, Momofuku, and not just for the noodles.
That's commentator Andy Raskin, who doesn't just dabble in ramen-related topics. He's working on a book called The Ramen King and I.
There's still some time before school starts to sneak in a final summer getaway. And rather than spend a pile of cash traveling to Disneyland or some distant national park, a lot of people are staying close to home this summer. We've been sending our reporters out to discover the obscure summer attractions near where they live. NPR's Chris Arnold takes us to a seafood mecca up the coast from Boston.
It's summertime here in Boston, and I wanted to find the best locally famous place to go get some seafood. So I called my friend Joe. One thing you should know about Joe, he loves seafood, particularly lobsters and clams.
Well, I grew up on the beach. You grow up on the beach, I think the natural inclination is to want to eat everything that you see. And then you get to the fried food, and then, oh my God, it's like anything fried is good, but a clam fried is heaven.
Joe, his last name's Doulette, digs clams himself. He's not a seafood professional. He teaches video production to high school kids, but he knows all kinds of clam and lobster shacks around New England.
Well, I used to work in a clam shack in Marblehead called Flinney's at the Beach. It just doesn't exist anymore, but I fried clams. And I brought calamari to the menu, too, because they weren't doing calamari.
So you are kind of a professional.
I would consider myself a frying professional. A professional
seafood.
Fryer. A professional seafood fryer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so we're in my car now, and we're going to go somewhere. Joe, where are we going?
We're heading to Woodman's, the birthplace of the fried clam.
What do you mean the birthplace of the fried clam?
It's where the fried clam was invented.
Woodman's Roadside Clam Shack in Essex, Massachusetts, is where nearly 100 years ago, they say the first clam was battered up and deep fried.
I don't know what life would have been like if the fried clam hadn't been invented. So this is kind of like a mecca.
All right, so we're pulling into Woodman's here.
Yeah, baby.
What are you thinking, Joe? What are you feeling?
I don't know. It's like the whole body just starts to, you know, kind of get itself ready. Just imagine the little fat bellies dropping into the oil. Start to salivate.
In Woodman's kitchen, standing between vats of hot lard with clams sizzling away in them, we find Steve Woodman. It was Steve's grandfather who started it all, the somewhat hefty man they called Chubby Woodman.
That's right, that was his nickname, Chubby.
The year was 1914. World War I was getting underway. Babe Ruth was a rookie for the Red Sox. That's when Chubby and his wife Bessie opened up a new store here. They sold fried potato chips to people passing by. The nearby mud flats were full of clams. And after a couple of years, Chubby got to thinking.
Actually, 92 years ago, my grandfather came up with the idea of
putting some fried clams in his chip fryolator to deep fry them. And July 4th, the parade was coming through, and he put a big sign out, fried clams, and sold $35 worth of product that day, and that's the most he ever took in any day of operation. So he wasn't a stupid man, so he kept them on the menu.
Since then, five generations of Woodmans have been working here, and a lot of people have come to love those fried clams. The restaurant's won all kinds of best seafood awards. This summer, they're selling about 20,000 clams in a single day on the weekends, with a line out the door and the kitchen staff calling out numbers as they come up.
271!
It's a great place to people watch. You could, in the same dining room, have a U.S. senator, a congressman, the table right next to him. Could be a family coming in that's not doing well, maybe on welfare, and just cash their check if they're coming here for a special treat.
So do the congressmen have to wait in line like everybody else? Or?
Yeah, they do.
In the back of the restaurant, retirees Alice and Richard Quinn are leaning back in their chairs after eating their lunch. Actually, the couple now lives in Arizona, but every time they're near Boston, they make sure to come back to Woodman's.
We've been coming here. My father took us here in the 1930s.
Wow.
Our kids remember coming here.
So what did you guys get today?
Got a lobster, clams, scallops, onion rings, and clam broth.
You don't get that in Arizona for sure.
And apart from all the tradition, you get to eat the clams.
That was a good clam. Pretty nice. They are good. I don't think we ordered enough clams.
Chris Arnold, NPR News.